Hey, Wiki listeners, it's Rachel.
And Victor, did you know I host the fantastic NYC Talent Show
every Monday night at the Parkside Lounge in New York City?
It's an off-off-Broadway showcase where you can see New York's underground performance art up close.
We've got weekly special guests like Colin Quinn, Janine Garofalo, Tone Bell, and lots more.
Use the code WIKILISTEN for a special discount on tickets when you go to nyctalentshow.com.
That's nyctalentshow.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This is the Wikipedia page for Qvert, part 2 of 2. Welcome to WikiListen, the podcast where we read Wikipedia pages and provide commentary. I'm Rachel Teichman, LMSW.
And I'm Victor Vernado, KSN, reminding everybody out there to subscribe, just like Coily. Coily, if you've been listening to the first half of this, people think he's the main antagonist in Qvert. You'd know that if you did listen to yesterday's episode. I hope you did.
I hope you did, too. And I'd like to thank Warren Davis for being here for part 2.
Oh, yeah. Fun fact, Warren Davis is still here.
my pleasure being here. Thanks for having me over last night, too. I really appreciate the sofa to sleep on. It was very comfortable.
You were very kind. I do want to know where those toenails came from, though.
No comment.
Shall we dive in? I believe you should take it away, Rachel.
Let's do it. Development. Concept. Programmer Warren Davis wrote that he was inspired by a pattern of hexagons implemented by fellow Gottlieb developer and Mad Planets designer Khan Yabumoto.
This is mostly true. I don't believe Khan created it. I think Jeff created it for him. I saw that on the screen. Khan was using it. He was actually using it just as eye candy. In other words, it was a background. We had a hardware that let you switch the background and foreground. And so basically he was using it to switch background and foreground, and he was using that as his background, but he wasn't doing anything functional with it. It was literally just something that filled the screen and looked pretty. In a different telling, the initial concept began when Jeff Lee drew a pyramid of cubes inspired by M.C. Escher. Lee believed a game could be derived from the artwork and created an orange, armless main character. The character jumped along the cubes and shot projectiles called mucus bombs from a tubular nose at enemies. Enemies included a blue creature, later changed purple and named Wrongway, and an orange creature, later changed green and named Sam. Lee had drawn similar characters since childhood, inspired by characters from comics, cartoons, Mad Magazine, and by artist Ed Big Daddy Roth. Qvert's design later included a speech balloon with a string of nonsensical characters, which Lee originally presented as a joke. All right, let's take a deep dive into this paragraph. Okay, so the initial concept did not begin when Jeff drew a pyramid of cubes because he created a background pattern for Khan, which filled the screen. The pyramid was something that I imagined to help me with my exercise of programming balls bouncing down. I also remember asking Jeff to give me artwork of a ball falling down because, you know, that is something I didn't feel I could create. I needed an artist to do a nice rounded ball. And I asked him to give me a deformed ball for when it lands, so it squishes a little. And then I went ahead and programmed a ball bouncing down the pyramid. But the character of Qvert didn't even enter the picture until I had programmed the ball bouncing down the pyramid. And then I went to Jeff and said, look, people think this is cool. I'm gonna try and put a player character. Do you have any characters lying around? And he said, yeah, I do. And he put them all up on the screen. So the Qbert character was definitely something he had created prior to my programming exercise.
We are going to break this Qbert Wikipedia page wide open.
Anyway, so let's see. Lee believed a game could be derived from the artwork and created an orange armless. Again, they're just getting the order backwards. Jeff had created the character before the Pyramid of Cubes. There's an interesting diagram on this page, you will notice. It is a hand-drawn sketch by Jeff Lee. And I've talked to Jeff about this. This was in his notebook. And when I asked Jeff, because Jeff was telling people that he came up with the original concept. And I said, Jeff, I created the pyramid. And he said, I thought Khan created the pyramid. I was like, no, I created the pyramid and put the balls bouncing around it. You must have come up with this once the balls were falling down. And that's where, you know, you had this concept of Qbert shooting out of his nose, which, again, I do remember. Jeff designed the character to shoot out of his nose.
Yes.
I never took that seriously as an option because it was way too complicated for the physics that I could program. I mean, I'm programming a pseudo 3D game in a completely 2D environment, and it's my first game. So I'm like, I don't want to take on too much that's, you know, complicated. So, you know, anyway, this whole paragraph is just wrong in so many ways. Now, I can't speak to the rest of this paragraph because I think, you know, some of it probably is true.
Implementation. Warren Davis, who is hired to work on the game Protector, noticed Lee's ideas and asked if he could use them to practice programming randomness and gravity as game mechanics.
You want me to comment?
I think you have to.
The only part of that is false is noticed Lee's ideas and asked. That is literally utterly false. I wasn't hired to work on Protector, but I was hired to make video games. And the first thing they did was assign me to Protector. So I'll give them that. It's a slight, very, very slight twisting of reality, but not much. Mm-hmm. But again, I mean, once my responsibilities to Protector were finished, basically management said, okay, Warren, make us a game. Make a game. That was literally the only task I was given. When I saw the cubes on Khan's screen, the first step for me was, I think I have a little bit more to learn. I want to program something with gravity and randomness. So that was something I did completely on my own. Had nothing to do with Jeff. Jeff was not involved. I didn't ask anybody if I could do it. I just did it.
Thus, he added balls that bounce from the pyramid's top to bottom. Because Davis was still learning how to program game mechanics, he wanted to keep the design simple. He also believed games with complex control schemes were frustrating and wanted something that could be played with one hand. To accomplish this,
I also have told the story where I wanted a game where I could hold a drink in one hand.
Oh, that sounds even better.
That is also true.
Agree.
To accomplish this, Davis removed the shooting and changed the objective of saving the protagonist from danger.
Well, okay, I never removed the shooting because there never was shooting. It just was never there, and I literally never considered it. I didn't change the objective because, again, there was no objective. The first thing that happened when I put in the player character was, yes, he needs to avoid the balls from hitting him. And then you may continue because I believe the rest of the paragraph is actually correct.
As Davis worked on the game one night, Gottlieb's vice president of engineering, Ron Waxman, noticed him and suggested to change the color of the cube after the game's character has landed on them. Davis implemented a unique control scheme. A four-way joystick was rotated 45 degrees to match the directions of Qbert's jumping. Staff members at Gottlieb urged for a more conventional orientation, but Davis stuck to his decision. Davis remembered to have started programming in April 1982, but the project was only put on the schedule as an actual product several months later.
A couple of things about the joystick. I never thought there was anything remotely controversial or original about rotating the joystick 45 degrees. It was, to me, utterly obvious. If you look at the play field, you don't move up, down, left, and right. You move up to the left, up to the right, down to the left, down to the right. I don't know why that was hard for so many people to wrap their brains around. It was, to me, it was a no-brainer. But it is not, it is correct to say that it was controversial. A lot of people did have problems with it. To this day, I do not understand why.
I think people just don't like change, you know?
Warren Davis Wilden in the 80s.
And as far as the putting on the schedule, it should say weeks. Believe it was put on the schedule several weeks later, not months.
Audio. A MOS Technology 6502 chip that operates at 894 kilohertz generates the sound effects, and a speech synthesizer by Votrax generates Qbert's incoherent expressions. The audio system uses 128 bytes of random access memory and 4 kilobytes of erasable programmable read-only memory to store the sound data and code to implement it. Like other Gottlieb games, the sound system was thoroughly tested to ensure it would handle daily usage. In retrospect, audio engineer David Thiel commented that such testing minimized time available for creative designing.
Thiel was tasked with using the synthesizer to produce English phrases for the game. However, he was unable to create coherent phrases and eventually chose to string together random phonemes instead. Thiel also believed the incoherent speech was a good fit for the in Qbert's speech balloon. Following a suggestion from technician Rick Tai, a pinball machine component known as a knocker was included to make a sound when the character falls off the pyramid. This knocker consists of a solenoid with a plunger that strikes the mounting bracket, which is in turn firmly fastened to the cabinet. Foam padding was added to the area of contact on the bracket. The developers decided the softer sound better matched a fall rather than a loud knocking sound. The cost of installing foam, however, was too expensive, and the padding was omitted.
Wait a second. So in the actual arcade cabinet, it would make a physical sound?
Yes.
Yeah. There was a pinball knocker.
What?
And when Qbert fell off, or I think Coily as well, anytime somebody fell off the pyramid, you would hear a loud knock at the bottom of the cabinet.
That's
like
wild.
Like they're falling into the video game.
Yeah, the idea was we wanted it to sound like a thud, like a body hitting the bottom of the cabinet, which with the foam, it kind of did. Without the foam, it just sounded like somebody knocking at the door. But still, a lot of people loved that feature. I was always, it was bittersweet because I knew how much better it could have sounded with the foam. But but that was also true. The only thing in this paragraph that is not exactly true, it says that Dave was unable to create coherent phrases from the speech synthesizer. That's actually untrue. That same chip was used to create English speech for pinball machines. That's why that chip was there. It had been used for many pinball games, and it would say lots of stuff in English. It just sounded like crap, and Dave thought it sounded like crap, and so he hated the sound of it. But that was the technology available at the time. But the fact that he came up with the idea to use random phonemes for Qbert's speech is absolutely true.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Here's also a quote from him, from David Thiel, quote, "We wanted the game to say, you've gotten 10,000 bonus points, and the closest I came to it after an entire day would be bogus points. Being very frustrated with this, I said, well, screw it. What if I just stick random numbers in the chip instead of all this highly authored stuff? What happens?" David Thiel on the creation of Qbert's incoherent swearing.
Wiki listeners, pick up your joysticks because it's time to listen to this quick message to help support us.
Thank you for listening to that message, Wiki listeners. We're back, finally, to find out what happens at the end of this Qbert article.
So put that joystick down and listen up.
Title: The Gottlieb staff had difficulty naming the game. Aside from the project name Cubes, it was untitled for most of the development process. The staff agreed the game should be named after the main character, but disagreed on the name. Lee's title for the initial concept, Snots and Boogers, was rejected, as was a list of suggestions compiled from company employees. According to Davis, Vice President of Marketing Howie Rubin championed the speech balloon. That's my editorial edition. As the title, although staff members argued it was silly and would be impossible to pronounce, a few early test models were produced with as the title on the unit's artwork. During a meeting, Hubert was suggested, and a staff member thought of combining cubes and Hubert into Cubert with a C-U. Art director Richard Tracy changed the name to Q-Bert, and the hyphen was later changed to an asterisk. In retrospect, Davis expressed regret for the asterisk because it prevented the name from becoming a common crossword term, and it is a wildcard character for search engines.
Is this true?
Partially. I did lament the asterisk for searches. When the asterisk became like the wild card, that did become a problem because you couldn't really search for Cubert by its original name. So, but as far as crossword puzzles, I don't remember ever thinking that the asterisk prevented it from being a crossword term.
But you don't think that it might be something you said off the cuff? I mean, you seem rather spirited.
It is very possible. It is very possible one day I said that. I can imagine myself like, I don't know, in an odd situation where I suddenly exclaim something in the moment that is never meant to be recorded and put down for posterity, but then somebody would. You know, can you imagine yourself in a situation where you just say something in the spur of the moment, and then how would you feel if somebody took that and put it down in some sort of an encyclopedia as a quote that you once said? You know what I mean?
I think I'd have to say my only answer could be that I have to feel good about it.
But the only addendum I was going to say is I have seen Cubert be the answer to crossword clues.
I've known it to be in a crossword myself. Mm-hmm. Testing. As development neared the production stage, Cubert underwent location tests in local arcades under its preliminary title, before being widely distributed. According to Jeff Lee, his oldest written record attesting to the game being playable as in a public location, a Brunswick bowling alley, dates back to September 11, 1982. Gottlieb also conducted focus groups in which the designers observed players through a one-way mirror. Did you do this?
Yeah, absolutely.
I have a question about that.
Sure.
Did you do that because you always wanted to use a one-way mirror?
No, see, I've always been a one-way mirror aficionado. No, I don't know. First of all, I had nothing to do with this. I didn't arrange any of the focus groups. This was a standard thing that was done in the industry. It was done in many industries. There were companies that you could hire to, you know, coordinate and make these focus groups. I also did focus groups, I remember, with Disney. Years later, when I was working with Disney making video games, we did focus groups on Disney home games. So it was a common practice. You'd go to a mall, you'd give people, you'd say, hey, you want to make $25 or $15 or whatever it was, adjusted for inflation back then. And that you'd get people to come in and play a game and give you their opinion. And it just so happened you'd be on the other side of a one-way mirror watching.
The control scheme received a mixed reaction during playtesting. Some players adapted quickly, while others found it frustrating. Initially, Davis was worried players would not adjust to the different controls. Some players would unintentionally jump up the pyramid several times, reaching a game over in about 10 seconds. Players, however, became accustomed to the controls after playing several rounds of the game. The different responses to the controls prompted Davis to reduce the game's level of difficulty, a decision that he would later regret.
I mean, generally accurate, although, you know, like, dun, dun, dun. The end of that paragraph definitely makes it seem a lot more dramatic than
I think
it was.
That was more my reading of it. I think it could have been like a decision which he would later regret.
A decision could have been. He would later regret. No, it wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, I had been making the game easier all through its development. People were coming to me in the office when we were just doing play testing in the office amongst Gottlieb employees. People would say, it's too fast, it's too hard, but slow it down. I continued to do that. And I would say that it had nothing to do with the control. That's another sort of, again, a little weird, falsehood. I didn't reduce the game's level of difficulty because of the controls. I reduced the level of difficulty because it generally seemed too hard for people. It really wasn't tied to the controls at all. So that's a weird, again, a weird sentence. As far as regretting, I do think I made it maybe a little too easy, and that prompted me to create faster, harder, more challenging Qbert after the original was released. That is true.
Release. Qbert is Gottlieb's fourth video game. A copyright claim registered with the United States Copyright Office by Gottlieb on February 10th, 1983, cites the date of publication of Qbert as October 18th, 1982. Video Games reported that the game was sold directly to arcade operators at its public showing at the AMOA show held November 18th through the 20th, 1982. Gottlieb offered the machines for $2,600 per unit.
Cashbox magazine listed the mass market U.S. release date as December 1982. The game was distributed in Japan by Konami and Sega in March 1983. It was also released in Europe in March 1983.
What was it like to have such a giant hit?
It was really unbelievable. It's hard to describe. I obviously was aware that the game was successful, but I was also completely anonymous. Nobody knew who I was. You know, that I was not in any way associated with the game or given any credit for the game. So nor was Jeff, nor Dave. So it was a weird thing. Like, I could be in an arcade and watch people play it. I wouldn't go up to people and go, hey, that's my game. I made that game.
You didn't? I would have at least a couple of times.
Yeah.
Well, let's put it this way. Even if it occurred to me, it also occurred to me like anybody could say that. Like, I have literally no proof or any way of proving that my claim is true. You know, recognition is a nice thing. It's a wonderful thing to be recognized for what you've done. I mean, with the, you know, the retro gaming resurgence of the people's love for their childhood games, I have now been the recipient of a lot of recognition. And it's just wonderful to see and to know that you've made a difference in people's lives, that you've created something that people have enjoyed. I honestly, that's the biggest reward for me was not any money, which I did not make from Qbert, or fame, which I did not get from Qbert. But the biggest reward for me was just knowing that people appreciated this thing that I had made. It's a very, very good feeling. I don't know if you've ever had that feeling in your life, but it's a very, very wonderful and satisfying feeling.
This has been the Wikipedia page for Qbert, part 2 of 2. Thanks for listening to WikiListen. You can find us at wikilisten.com and on all social media and on TikTok at WikiListen, except for Twitter, which is at wiki_listen. Don't forget to smash that subscribe button for your gratitude for having Warren Davis on.
Well, thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it. And hey, maybe somebody can get my Qbert, not my Qbert, my personal page reinstated.
It might be possible.
Wiki listeners, do it. Please, somebody, anybody.
If there's a particular page you'd like us to read, please let us know. We'll read it.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.